The sound of H1, the timepiece that shook the naval world 280 years ago. We'll meet it this week on Planetary Radio. Welcome to the travel show that takes you to the final frontier. I'm Matt Kaplan of the Planetary Society. Come with me today to the zero meridian, the line that begins and ends longitude on planet Earth. And the quest for longitude, or an accurate way to determine it, will be my topic with the curator of the Royal Observatory Greenwich, Dr. Louise DeVoy. Bill Nye is on vacation this week. Bruce Betts will join us later to solve a radioactive puzzle. Here and now is senior editor Emily Lakdawalla with yet more excitement delivered by the New Horizons spacecraft. Emily, how did you react to that image of, really, Pluto's atmosphere?
I literally gasped. I just couldn't believe what I was seeing. I mean, I don't really know what I expected from the look back images, but I certainly didn't expect anything as dramatic as these layers of haze floating quite a long way away up above the surface of Pluto.
And I guess you weren't the only one who was surprised.
I think it's safe to say that everybody was surprised by these pictures. I've heard of scientists crying, in fact, at seeing this photo. It's really quite amazing.
Do we know what we're looking at here? What is that haze?
Well, it's a haze. Haze is particles suspended in the atmosphere. They're very, very good at scattering light forward to the viewer if you have them backlit by the sun, and that's the lighting situation here. They're probably created up there in the atmosphere when solar ultraviolet radiation knocks apart smaller molecules like methane and nitrogen in the atmosphere, and they recombine into longer and longer materials called tholins, which eventually settle down on the surface. This kind of stuff happens at Triton and at Titan, and it's quite likely that it's happening on other worlds in the Kuiper Belt.
Speaking of Titan, talk about this comparison that you put up.
Yeah, so when I first saw the full disk look-back image, it's really quite striking because you can see Pluto's atmosphere forming a complete circle, a ring around the disk. And it's not even an eclipse. The sun isn't behind the disk of Pluto. It's off to one side. It's just that the atmosphere is so tall that you can see it scattering sunlight all the way around. And you can see something very similar on Titan when Cassini has a similar point of view. In fact, both of them are the same phase angle, 165 degrees, meaning that the sun isn't directly in front of, just a little to the side of being in front of you. And it just lights up the whole atmosphere like a ring.
People can take a look at this great blog entry by Emily. She posted it on the 25th at planetary.org, and it's called Looking Back at Pluto. There is one term I want you to explain here that you use as you describe these images. You say they've been deconvolved. Do I have that right?
Yes. What we're looking at, we're looking at these processed images from the long-range reconnaissance imager, or LORI, on New Horizons. And LORI, like any other camera, has a point spread function, where if you point it at a light source, that's a point light source, you won't see just one pixel light up. You'll see a couple of pixels light up. Most of the light will be in one pixel, but then the surrounding pixels will get a little light too. It's a very slight blur, and it's not a defect. It's actually done on purpose with some cameras in order to make sure that you can more accurately target, you can determine precisely where a point source of light is. But in order to make the images look sharper, they process the pictures knowing what the shape of the point spread function is, trying to remove that effect from it, and it makes the images sharper. It takes some computing power, but it gives us a crisper view of Pluto.
Got it. Thanks, Emily. And congratulations on the completion of your Pluto montage, which is also part of this blog entry.
Thank you, Matt.
She is our senior editor, planetary evangelist for the Planetary Society, and a contributing editor to Sky and Telescope magazine. Enjoy your vacation, Emily. We'll talk to you again in a couple of weeks. I was on vacation in the United Kingdom not long ago. A highlight of that holiday was my pilgrimage to one of our planet's most intriguing and exciting science landmarks. The Royal Observatory Greenwich sits atop a hill in the midst of a beautiful park, not far from the Thames. I arrived early on that June morning, well before the public exhibition hours, with time to visit the lovely gardens just below the complex. Looking up, I saw atop a pole the famous bright red time ball that is still dropped at precisely 1 p.m. Greenwich Mean Time each day. I was about to meet Louise DeVoy, the enthusiastic curator of all that this wonderful facility contains. Our focus would be on one large room. Dr. DeVoy, thank you so much for welcoming us to the Royal Observatory, Greenwich. It is thrilling to be here.
Well, thank you for coming over. It's a joy to share these amazing objects with you today.
And we are standing in front of one of the most amazing objects.
So John Harrison started working on these marine timekeepers in response partly to the 1714 Act of Longitude, in which a reward fund of about £20,000 was set up by the British government to be awarded to anyone who could find a feasible way of determining longitude at sea.
May not sound like that much nowadays, but it would be worth millions in today's currency, right?
Absolutely. It was an immense fortune. And like all prize funds or reward funds, it attracted lots of weird and wonderful ideas. It almost became a byword for madness or a crazy idea, something like perpetual motion. There are several satirical poems and different forms of literature that mock the idea. But some philosophers at the time and mathematicians and horologists were keen to resolve the problem in a feasible way. And eventually there were two sort of main strands of approach. One was the astronomical method, where you were trying to determine your longitude using the position of the moon against the background stars and comparing that against almanacs of data. Then you'd have the timekeeper method, where you're trying to compare your local time against a reference time, which is what your timekeeper would effectively hold for you. So you'd measure your local time and compare it against, say, Greenwich time compared to what your timekeeper was set to.
Why was this such an important goal?
Well, actually, the story starts much earlier, back in the 1670s, when the observatory was set up. So at that time, international trade between Europe, Africa, Asia was really booming. Merchants were quite willing to send out their ships and crews to far-off destinations to bring back very luxurious products, such as tea, coffee, spices, ceramics. And the profits were really worth the risk. But obviously, once you're out in a featureless ocean, it's very difficult to find out where you are. You haven't got any particular landmarks to help you. And it's much more likely that you'll veer off course. So there was a huge risk in taking those voyages. And anything that could be done to reduce the length of those voyages to make navigation easier and more accurate was really desirable, both from a commercial point of view, but also politically as well, in terms of reaching other countries.
So determining your latitude, north-south on the globe, not terribly difficult. That had been worked out, but mostly by position of the sun. But longitude, that was a real challenge.
Yes, with latitude, you have the equator as a sort of natural reference point, so you're either north or south of the equator. But for longitude, your east-west position, there is no such natural equivalent. It's completely arbitrary whether you choose Paris or Greenwich or wherever as your zero point. So much more difficult.
This is the zero point, almost where we're standing.
Almost, yes. Just a few metres over to the east is the prime meridian, or 0 degrees longitude. So 360 degrees around the globe. So you can measure your position relative to that one line. The problem is trying to get everyone to agree to use the same line.
I read that a lot of folks in Paris, in France, decided or felt that really it deserved to be through Paris.
Yes, and there were before the decision to use the meridian here at Greenwich, there were other countries that had their own meridians, whether it was through Rio or St. Petersburg. There was just a whole range of different values. Yeah.
Well, I'm glad we could all agree on something around the world. So the prize was offered, and there were these two approaches that you began to talk about. One of them having very much to do with the observatory right from the start, the astronomical. Can you talk a little bit about why that presented such a challenge?
When the observatory was set up in 1675, the first astronomer royal, John Flamsteed, was tasked with creating a very accurate star chart and catalogue that could be used by mariners. But Flamsteed took rather a long time to get going with his data. He worked for several decades without really publishing anything, so other ideas came about as well. The idea with the astronomical method is that you need three key pieces of information. So the first is your local time, which, as we said, you can measure using the sun or stars. Then you need to measure the angular distance between the moon and a certain bright star. This gives us the name, the lunar distance method. And then finally, you need your reference. So you need an almanac that shows you the angular distance between the moon and the bright stars as seen from a particular known location.
Because that would shift depending on where you were.
Yes, so that comparison then gives you your measure of longitude. So the astronomical method, it had been devised over gosh, even 150 years, even before Flamsteed. So it'd been an idea that had been brewing for a long time, but it was still very much a theory. Trying to get it work in practice, you still needed accurate instruments for measuring this angular distance between the moon and the stars, but also you needed accurate star charts, and that's where the observatory came in to really try and produce that data.
There are so many fascinating aspects to this story. Isaac Newton played a role, and it wasn't an entirely genial one.
No. Once the observatory had been set up, Flamsteed was collecting all this data. By the 1690s, Newton was starting to get a little bit impatient. He'd already published the Principia, but he really wanted Flamsteed's accurate data to develop his ideas even further, particularly in relation to the motion of the moon. Newton managed to persuade Flamsteed to hand over some of the data, and Flamsteed agreed, thinking that it was just between friends, and the correspondence is quite chatty, quite friendly. And then you can imagine Flamsteed's horror then in 1712, when he found that his work had been published by Newton and Halley as a sort of somewhat pirate copy.
Halley of Halley's Comet fame.
Exactly, Edmund Halley, who would later succeed Flamsteed as the next Astronomer Royal, ironically. So Flamsteed spent the next few years trying to recall many copies. I think about 400 copies of this pirate version had been published. And with support from the king, Flamsteed managed to recall about 300 of them. And legend is that he burnt them here in the park as a sacrifice to heavenly truth. So it wasn't particularly friendly relations. And it took another 10 years or so before Flamsteed's work was eventually published, the official version, about 5 years after his death.
We'll talk more with Louise DeVoy about the quest for longitude in a minute. This is Planetary Radio.
Hey, Bill Nye here. I'd like to introduce you to Merk Boyan.
Hello.
He's been making all those fabulous videos, which hundreds of thousands of you have been watching.
That's right.
We're going to put all the videos in one place, Merk, is that right?
Planetary TV.
So I can watch them on my television?
No.
So wait a minute, Planetary TV's not on TV?
That's the best thing about it. They're all going to be online. You can watch them anytime you want.
Where do I watch Planetary TV then, Merk?
Well, you can watch it all at planetary.org/TV.
Random Space Fact! Nothing new about that for you, Planetary Radio fans, right? Wrong! Random Space Fact is now a video series, too. And it's brilliant, isn't it, Matt?
I hate to say it, folks, but it really is, and hilarious.
See? Matt would never lie to you, would he?
I really wouldn't.
A new Random Space Fact video is released each Friday at youtube.com/planetarysociety. You can subscribe to join our growing community, and you'll never miss a fact.
Can I go back to my radio now?
Welcome back to Planetary Radio. I'm Matt Kaplan. More now from my conversation with curator Louise DeVoy of the Royal Observatory Greenwich. You can hear my complete and fascinating 30-minute conversation with Louise about the quest for longitude in the online version of today's show. That quest began in earnest with the work of the first Astronomer Royal, John Flamsteed. Flamsteed's challenges were in the sky. The challenges for Harrison were down here at the surface, particularly at sea, and they were very substantial. I mean, why was it so difficult to make a clock that would run accurately, particularly on a ship?
There are essentially three main problems with trying to run a pendulum-based timekeeper at sea. So the first problem is obviously motion. When you're on land and you've got your pendulum clock installed in your hallway, it can run quite regularly, no problem. But imagine trying to be on a ship. Your ship is pitching and rolling all over the place. Trying to keep a nice, steady, regular beat is virtually impossible. The other problem then is temperature change. As you can imagine, we're here in the UK, so a fairly temperate climate. But then if you head further south, you might get more tropical extremes, higher temperatures, which then may cause materials, especially metals, to expand. And then if you go further south to colder regions, then obviously the metals contract. So there's a huge range of temperatures that can really affect the rates of the device. The third criteria really is oil as well. You can imagine these are made of several thousand parts. You want to try and keep them all running smoothly. The oils that were used at this time were often quite problematic and usually caused more problems than they solved. And that's one of the approaches where we can really see Harrison's skill as a carpenter come in. Because if you look closely at H1, you'll notice that some of the components are made of wood. And this is actually made of lignum vitae, which is a tropical hardwood that has these natural oils that keep it supple. So Harrison was able to draw on that knowledge and incorporate that into his design.
So no additional lubrication, nothing done from the outside?
Not for those parts, yeah, very much. And that really, really does help the design.
so many other innovations that I read about as I learned more about Harrison's work. It's just a marvelous device to look at, with these springs and dual pendulums, vertical pendulums swinging back and forth behind there. He was a mechanical genius.
Yes, and some of his ideas have made the transition from horology into other applications as well. So, for example, in H3, we have the bimetallic strip. So a piece of brass and steel riveted together, which expand and contract at opposite rates so as to sort of cancel out. You'll find this even today in your kettle or your toaster or your thermostat.
The thermostat on my wall.
Exactly, exactly. So that idea is still running through technology today. There's also some caged roller bearings on H3 as well that you'll often find in complex machinery as a way of making them more efficient and reducing friction. Some great concepts that have really endured and run through today's technology as well.
As marvelous as these devices are, this is completely revolutionary, because he goes from these relatively huge devices to what we have in front of us now.
Yes, and ironically, this is one that visitors often walk past because it looks just like a giant pocket watch. But actually, this is the timekeeper that effectively won Harrison the reward. So it's now known as H4. The story is that Harrison was getting increasingly frustrated with H3. He was working on other projects, like all of us, working on several projects at once. And he realized that actually a watch might be a better solution rather than these big, clunky timekeepers that we've just seen so far. Now, conventional wisdom at the time was that a watch wouldn't be able to cope with the demands of travel at sea. It was too lightweight. But Harrison realized actually one of the main things to do is to make sure it beats very quickly, because that the quicker it beats, the less susceptible it is to the effects of motion. Mm. So this actually beats 5 times a second. And it also has these jeweled bearings to reduce friction and energy losses. So Harrison took many of the ideas that he developed in the earlier versions and sort of condensed them down into this very compact version, H4.
As you said, this is the one that really set the course for the chronometers that are still used on some ships today.
Absolutely, yes. So Harrison was awarded half of the prize fund, so £10,000. To try and get the remainder, he had to hand over his designs, which were then sent to other London clockmakers, and they had to prove that they could make something fairly easily, that it wasn't just a one-off fluke.
Because this was a very expensive device.
Yes, very expensive, very complex. So Harrison had to demonstrate that this knowledge could be passed on to someone else to make a similar device. And from that, we have the emergence of what then became known as the chronometer, which by the 1840s had become sort of standard issue on Royal Navy ships.
He was not happy, was he, about only being given half the prize?
No, it took a lot of haggling and petitioning from the king to really get Harrison the final amount. His son was involved as well. He did finally receive a lump sum just a few years before he died. I think some calculations even suggest that he might have even earned slightly more than the total prize fund if you add up all the intervening amounts that are awarded to help him develop the timekeepers.
Did one of these methods, the timepieces or the astronomical, did one win, or did they both come into use?
I think they both came into use, yes, because you still need to use instruments for measuring your local time to then compare against your reference time, whether you're using a chronometer or the tables of data. And interestingly, in recent years, some navies have actually started to bring back some of these more traditional methods because they're worried about being over-reliant on global positioning systems in case there's any satellite failure or some sort of solar storm that could knock out all these satellites.
Or even some kind of hostile action against satellites.
Exactly. We're all very vulnerable to that kind of attack. And so I think some places now they're actually bringing back some of these traditional methods using sextants and tables of data so that people can actually do it if they needed to.
Any astronomer listening to this certainly knows right ascension, declination. They are to the universe what latitude and longitude are for those of us stuck down here on the surface. I read that John Flamsteed may have been the first to use those, or at least right ascension.
Yes, certainly when he was compiling his star catalogue, he listed the stars in order of increasing right extension. This became sort of the foundations, if you like, for modern star atlases and star charts.
Yeah, it's how we now find any object in the sky. You look up the right ascension and declination. Not being much of an astronomer, I just plug those into my telescope's computer.
Exactly. And also, I mean, the great joy with the equatorially mounted telescopes as well is that they could be used for astrophotography. Mm. If you imagine with your transit telescope or your altazimuth mount telescope, you can only look at certain parts of the sky and you have to constantly adjust the telescope. Whereas with the equatorial mount, you can really track the movement of the stars, which is ideal if you want to take long exposure photographs.
As I look at these timepieces, these clocks behind us here, when we first came into the room, I had the same feeling, the same thrill that I've had when I have stood in front of, for one example, Curiosity, the Mars Science Laboratory rover, before it left the Jet Propulsion Lab. Or when I walked around an experimental fusion reactor. It's that same feeling of pushing the edge of human knowledge, which is just incredibly exciting to me. I mean, does that seem to ring true for you?
Yes, and I think these devices really give a sense of the work that's involved, and also I think they remind us of how much of it is a team effort as well. We think about Flamsteed and Harrison, but both of them were supported by friends and family who made it all possible. Mm.
It has been so delightful to be able to spend a few minutes with you here at the Royal Observatory Greenwich and actually stand in front of these devices, and I just want to thank you for giving us the opportunity.
Oh, thank you, my pleasure, and I hope you get to look around and enjoy it for slightly longer.
Yeah. I look forward to it very much.
Time for What's Up on Planetary Radio, which means it's time to talk to the Director of Science and Technology for the Planetary Society. But he has a new title now, Program Manager for
Chocolate.
Yeah, well, but you had that title ages ago. No, for LightSail. I just learned this last week. Congratulations.
Why, thank you.
Tell us about this. What's your job?
I have multiple components. So what happened was Doug Stetson, who is basically doing a program and project manager type role, has stepped aside because he's a busy guy. And Dave Spencer at Georgia Tech, who is mission manager on the first LightSail, is the project manager, so handling all the technical management and stuff. And as program manager, I'll be a prime interface with the Planetary Society and the rest of our staff, like you. And that's the sad part of my job.
But thank you very much.
I'll also be handling exciting things that'll be way better than talking to you, like contracts.
Oh, yeah. It took a moment to register that you were being ironic.
and budgets and, you know, the fun stuff.
You can admit it. This will be the best part of the job, talking to me, giving us updates. Maybe not weekly, but at least we'll have somebody handy that we can talk to about where the project is going.
It's true. I'll be handy and tracking what's going on directly in the flow of information. So, yeah. No, you're right, Matt. The best part of my job is talking to you.
Oh.
No matter how the titles change.
All right. Enough of that crap. Get on with it. What's up?
Golly. Well, it's a slow week in planet land in the sky, although you can try because they're really bright to still catch Venus and Jupiter soon after sunset, low in the west, but they're getting very low. Saturn, the easy target, it's up in the south in the early evening. A preview, we've got the Perseid meteor shower peaking like August 12th, 13th, but actually increased shower counts starting even as early as now for the next 2-3 weeks. But I'll remind you next week.
Man, it seems like it was only last year we were talking about the Perseids.
I know, it's weird. On to this week in space history. It was 1971 that Apollo 15 was landing on the moon and the first humans driving a car on the moon.
Not just a car, a dune buggy.
The lunar roving vehicle, please.
Yeah, well, you can call it that.
We'll see what other people think we should call it later in the show, but first, on to Random Space Effect!
Okay.
Apollo 15 was the first Apollo to release a sub-satellite into lunar orbit. Shortly before leaving lunar orbit, Apollo 15 released PFS-1, a small satellite to study plasma, particle, and magnetic field environment of the moon and do a little lunar gravity mapping. All right, we move on to the trivia contest. We asked you, what was the mass of plutonium flown on the New Horizons mission? How'd we do?
How we did is an interesting question. Well, big response, but something of a discrepancy in the answer, which I'll allow you to explain in a moment. But first, Random.org chose Brian Foster of Mililani, Hawaii. Aloha, Brian. He said 10.9 kilograms of plutonium-238, which is the answer we got from almost everyone. I think there may only be one exception. Is he correct?
No. No, this is an interesting case where I believe everyone is wrong. And there's a second issue where I wasn't quite as precise as I should have been. But here's the deal. There were 10.9 kilograms, the answer almost everyone gave. That was the design baseline for New Horizons. That is not what they flew because of various issues, including a shutdown at Los Alamos in 2004. There were delays in fuel processing. Anyway, nutshell, RTG was filled with only 9.75 kilograms of plutonium dioxide. Now, we, in researching this, found that Wikipedia is what listed 10.9, and everyone bit into that. But Wikipedia cites a source from 2003, which was when they were still doing design baseline and had not reduced the amount. Now, there is a separate issue. Did you want to bring that up?
You know, we should bring that up because The one person, Ed Lupin, down in Sunnyvale, California, he said, you probably intend to accept the answer, 10.9 kilograms.
No.
He said, but if you do, I must protest strongly. That's the mass, he says, of the plutonium dioxide. Please explain.
So this is a separate issue. So again, he was using the 10.9 and the 9.75 seem to be the mass of plutonium dioxide, which is the way you pack plutonium into a spacecraft. So technically, it would be slightly less than 9.75 since I, being imprecise, asked how much mass of plutonium there would be. However, the plutonium atoms are much, much like, you know, order of magnitude heavier than the oxygen atoms, ballpark. So it's still close to the answer, but there's even that subtlety. But since,
So a very complex answer, but good work, Sherlock. Thank you for figuring this all out. We are going to send the Planetary Radio T-shirt to Brian Foster. And I did say 2 weeks ago that we would have a little bonus here. It is a brand
plutonium.
New...
Yeah, right. Or is it plutonium dioxide? I always get confused.
I think the dioxide because it's so much safer. No, we're going to send him a brand new light sail patch. And it is beautiful. It is absolutely gorgeous. I've actually only seen pictures. I haven't seen one in person, but it looks really cool. Honorable mention, better than honorable mention, also to Ed Lupin for going into a bit more detail. Take us on into the new contest.
All right. I've learned a lesson. Here's a question that has no right answer. If you were a car company trying to market the lunar roving vehicle for whatever purpose, what would you name it? And what would your slogan be for it? We will judge on humor and or effectiveness or however the mood strikes us. Go to planetary.org/radio contest. Get us your entry.
Got that right. However the mood strikes us. That is the way we roll, as did the car on the moon.
Is that your slogan?
No. I'm not submitting. You have until the 4th. That would be August 4th, Tuesday at 8 a.m. Pacific time, to get us this answer and Planetary Radio T-shirt and a cool light sail patch will be the prize.
All right, everybody. Go out there, look up the night sky, and think about radioactive rice. Thank you, and good night.
It's so good for you. He's Bruce Betts, the Director of Projects for the Planetary Society, and... now the Light Sail Program Manager. He will continue to join us in spite of that every week here for What's Up. Planetary Radio is produced by the Planetary Society in Pasadena, California, and is made possible by the timely members of the Society. Daniel Gunn is our associate producer. Josh Doyle created the theme. I'm Matt Kaplan. Clear skies.